Okay, let's get started. So first off, before I start talking about this, you all are very behind on your experiences. I can say this is a blanket statement because I've seen how many are turned in, and there haven't been many turned in. This is not good, especially since, and I've not put it very explicitly because this reflects what I've taught in classes, like, do something for about 2 to 4 hours that will help you learn about security. Write up what you've done and submit it. That's what I'm asking about experiences. A lot of you have been asking, like, oh, I don't know. It's like, is there something you don't know in security? The answer is yes. So learn about it or do something with it. The only restriction I'm willing to play is I don't want you to do all offensive technologies. I don't want you to do, all of your 8 write-ups on, like, how to, break into a system. Okay? I don't want you to do all offensive technologies. You do half. If you want to do an experience where you take an old, take a machine that's vulnerable and develop an exploit for it, sure. Or get Metasploit running and try to break into a box and talk about how that went, fine. I mean, all those things will take a couple hours, at least.
If you get, if you start something that turns out to be more difficult than you expected,
I do not expect you necessarily to complete it. When I say 2 to 4 hours, I mean 2 to 4 hours. I mean, make an honest try, but a lot of these things are not 2 to 4 hour tasks. They're 20 to 40 to 400 hour tasks. You should be able to get far enough to realize the scale of the problem you are doing. Now, I am potentially open, if you really want to do multiple experiences on the same thing. Like, you kind of split, like, this really big thing you want to do really is worth, like, 3 experiences or something. I'm not writing that down explicitly because I'm betting that most of you shouldn't do this. And I kind of want to make sure it chunks together nicely, as that, and it's worth putting all that time. I'd much rather you go for breadth than depth. Not that I don't care about depth, but I mean, it's, if you sit there and just spend 50 hours working on an exploit for one, thing, which some of these things require that kind of time. If you want to do a heap spraying attack, to circumvent address space layout protection and to circumvent all the non-execute memory in a modern browser, people spend months hardcore trying to develop these exploits. I mean, it's an arbitrary time sink. So I don't want you to, you want to do that on your own, fine. You're probably gonna fail all your classes if you do that, but go ahead. But I want you to try out different things. Like, one thing I was just thinking about this morning was, like, try to understand the network traffic coming out of your network. How much of it's encrypted? Can you decrypt any of it, given the keys from your network? What is chattering away on your network? You start playing with Wireshark, you start doing this. This is a problem that can take you a lot more than 4 hours, if you ever looked at any stuff. It's complicated.
So if you don't expect this completed, do you hand in our codes with it as well, or just the PDF of the write-up?
I want you to report on what you did. Sometimes it may make sense to give the code. Sometimes it may not be.
Could you give, snippets of the code?
Yes, exactly. I mean, what I taught at Target Sprint is, what did you learn? What was the hard problem you had to solve? I managed to, if you did say, oh, wow, I did that and I solved it, I'm very proud of my code. You say, here, look, see, look from the school. You want to show off some stuff you did? Sure. And you go, my code was completely broken and stuff, and you put it there. And then maybe you want to talk to me during office hours and say, what went wrong? Why did this work? Sure. But the emphasis is much more on you. This is a self-learning set of exercises. Because the only way you get good at computer science in general, but security in particular, is by going out there and wrestling with the resources and learning it on your own. That's all this experience structure is you going out. I specifically have made it vague for that reason. Because it's supposed to be self-learning. And in particular, I know there's huge variance in your background. Some of you sitting down on a system and just trying to configure permissions properly, for instance, may be a full experience because you just don't understand permissions. Okay, for some of you, you can teach a class on permissions. It's huge variation in what it is. I don't want you to do experiences on things you already know. And that's the thing I can tell from the write-up, is because if you write about something you actually know about, it's kind of hard to look like you don't know what you're talking about. You can try, but it's actually pretty hard. If you write it, it shows if you saying, oh wow, that made sense, and that fit together. I want to see that process.
So there's another question here.
Yes. What gets you a 4? Can you go over the grading criteria again?
So the grading criteria is 3 is kind of, basically, if you do something reasonable, you can get a 3. If you do something impressive, you get a 4. Now again, I wouldn't sweat too much about 3s, because a 3 is a B. It's 75%. And if you do well on other things, if you're looking for that A and you want to do that, well then no. Rather than 4 hours, you might want to spend like maybe 5 or 6 hours or things. I'm not expecting like to do 40 hours per experience or something like that. But make a genuine effort. It seems kind of vague, but you can kind of tell if someone's like, okay, you kind of did, you did it, you did okay, fine, versus, wow, they really tried there.
Yesterday I checked, there wasn't a hidden link on CLearn for Ascend 2.
I will put that up after class. That's been on my
okay.
I'm about to talk about So anything else on experiences? Just sit down and do something. And turn it in. These are things that should not... I know I've covered crazy amounts of things, like in terms of referring to things that you all do not know about. Now, one thing I will say is I have added some papers. I don't know if this is necessarily good or bad for you to read these. This is why I'm definitely not requiring these. But if you're interested, so the two sets I've done is an intrusion detection model by Dorothy Denning and Delvin Cheswick's network firewalls. This is the easier one. not to say it would be as easy, but these are old papers making references to systems that you don't know. The intrusion detection model is much more theoretical, network firewalls kind of, but these are foundational papers. In the sense of, this is the first paper that's talked about network firewalls. And this actually isn't the first thing about intrusion detection. There's actually something from the 70s, a technical report out of the Air Force, I think, U.S. Air Force. But this is kind of one of the first academic publications and actually kind of trying to formalize the idea of an intrusion detection system. And then here, this is computer viruses. Who coined it? Well, actually, I'm not even sure he necessarily coined it. He's kind of given credit for coining it, computer viruses, but he certainly is the first one to really seriously think about it, what it means to be a computer virus, and what it is. So he's got a number of publications. If you really want to go crazy, read his dissertation on computer viruses, which is hard to find. But this is just, this article here is a report on computer virus, again from 87. And then next generation, people knew about viruses before 87. People were talking about things on Apple TVs or computer viruses, but he actually formalized it. And then the next generation intrusion detection expert system, NIDES. This is the earliest, as I said, there is an earlier system for doing intrusion detection. Actually, done by Anderson. That was in the late 70s. This was SRI, International. Have you all heard of SRI? So, in the US, the big universities normally do research in collaboration with the military industrial complex in various ways, the US military intelligence agencies and such. So, much of that work is classified. During the Vietnam War, the notion of people associated with the university doing classified research for the military kind of got a bad name. for reasons here. So what happened was is various these universities spun off their classified research into separate institutes. MIT created the Lincoln Laboratories. So it's MIT Lincoln Laboratories. Stanford created SRI. So I think there's a couple of others. Those are the two big ones I know about. So anyway, that's where that came out. They were tasked with trying to build an intrusion detection system. We haven't talked a lot about intrusion detection systems yet. We will, because that's one of my big interests.
The name of your wiki.
Yes. But you know, feel free if you have other sets of papers you want to read about, that's fine. If you do all, again, for any one thing, plan on doing half. If you decide you want to do a lot of readings, half of your responses, and maybe run the papers you want to buy. I'd like you to read good papers if you're going to do things. There's a lot of crap out there. So. Run the by me on the wiki. I have not been on the. Run me on Slack. I have not been on Slack. I will be on Slack. Today. I'm back. Question here. Play with the pencil. So assignment two. So again, was later than I wanted to, but I don't think this is that difficult. I'd like you to get this done by Wednesday. If you all feel like this is definitely challenging, we're going to have to move the midterm past Monday. And right now, I've already set it to Monday, so I prefer not to push.
We're still doing the review before the.
Exactly. The idea is Wednesday. I'm going to go over the answers to this. So if I put it off, I can't go over the answers. So I'm doing the midterm. So today, I'd like to just kind of.
Just about question three.
There was a word. Someone mentioned. I saw someone.
Yeah, the second sentence is it just like
what information does the essay planner leave, and how is this information used?
It's just the same for question two, so I wasn't sure if that was just a mistake or not.
What in the world?
Yeah, one's for SSH, one's for web browser. They just copy and paste.
It's a different question I didn't edit it fully. That was the. Let's fix that. Okay. How does web browser anyway suggest? When does the web browser receive, and how is this information used? There we go. So now is the time. If there are questions on here that are unclear or going like, what the heck are you talking about here? I will leak information, but you have to ask. Okay? Looks pretty straightforward. Yeah, I tried to look back at what we had talked about and tried to. I don't feel like this midterm is going to be very hard. But yes.
Well, based on the assignment.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So moving on. Who's taking notes? Okay. I'm more serious about taking notes. Okay. So what I want to talk about today is malware. What is it? And why do we care? And what does it have to do with all the other stuff we're talking about? Let's kind of talk about terminology here. There's vulnerability and there's exploits, and then there's malware.
It's a malicious software.
malicious, bad, you know, depending on what the etymology you want to. But how, again, what's the relationship between, so what's a vulnerability?
Something exploitable.
Something exploitable. Okay, so that's, yeah. So what really, I mean, a vulnerability is, it's a hole in the defenses. And there's somewhere your security is, your security mechanism is supposed to provide certain guarantees. A vulnerability is a chink in that armor, basically, where that security guarantee doesn't quite hold. There's a way to get around. Like, oh, you're not supposed to be able to see what another process is doing. Oh, but you can. You're not supposed to be able to run code remotely. Oh, but you can. You know, this. So the vulnerability is saying there's a way to get around the security. An exploit is code that gets around the security. So someone often will say, oh, we think there's this vulnerability in this program, and they'll make a report, and they'll tell the thing. And a lot of times what will happen is the developers won't believe them. They'll say, that's not a bug. Or they'll say, okay, yeah, it causes a crash, but no one can actually compromise the security. They might just be able to make a crash. What's the big deal? And they'll go, and they might argue with them. And so the best argument against this sort of reluctance to acknowledge the scale of the problem is for someone to develop an exploit. So a lot of times, as part of a vulnerability report, people say, here, it's just like, it's like for a bug report. You say there's a bug in something. What's the best way to show that there's actually a bug? You give them an example of saying, if you do this, this, and this, you will see the bug manifest. And if you don't include the things for replicating the bug, then, well, you they go like, well, no, there's no bug. I don't see a problem. I don't know. And they ignore it.
So just to clarify, an exploit may or may not use vulnerabilities to complete it.
An exploit is always based on a vulnerability. That's what an exploit is. Because exploit is getting around. It's taking advantage of a vulnerability.
Right, but that, vulnerability is like a hole in the security.
Exactly.
No, but if you let's say you put a USB on, so you get around the security, but then the code takes advantage of something else inside, you're not actually like getting through the security with the exploit, you're just sort of...
So, okay, so let me clarify. Normally when I think of software, vulnerability, I'm really talking about software. Although you could say you can kind of think of the same way exploits, like, okay, let's see, stick a USB stick in and show you that you can do stuff. Normally you don't talk about exploits in those cases where it's a trivial exploit. I mean, that's in effect, it's a demonstration, because it's like, well, yeah, you can read stuff from the USB stick. Now, where you would have an exploit in that case is normally it's not that you can read things from USB sticks, like when people worry about that, it's that by inserting a USB stick, you can compromise the system. That requires an exploit, because that's exploiting a particular piece of software. Like, for example, there are some, Stuxnet took advantage of, like, you put files on the desktop and the file name or something. There was, like, some font rendering stuff, or I'd have to look back at what it was, but some really simple things like, oh, you just play with the font, or you just play with an image, and by decoding the image, all of a sudden, now you've compromised your kernel. But what? Why should that happen? So, but is not this. These are different things. Malicious software, malware, can use exploits which take advantage of vulnerabilities present in the system. But malware does not have to take care of any software vulnerability. In some sense, anytime a security mechanism is bypassed, there is a vulnerability of some kind. But the vulnerability often isn't, the software isn't at fault, except maybe in almost a philosophical sense, or maybe in a design sense. For example, much of the malicious software we see installed on systems today has been installed by a user. A user says, install that application. And so the system installs it, and it happens to include, you know, malicious code in it. So there wasn't the software itself wasn't vulnerable, except that it allows a user to install programs. What really happened was is the person installing it was able to be fooled into installing this bit of malicious software. But even then, it's not even clear if did they necessarily make a mistake. Maybe the attacker made the code look like something legitimate, and there was no way for someone to be able to tell the difference between the two. Maybe it even came from the software distributor themselves. So figuring out exactly what led to malicious software getting installed in a system sometimes is rather hard. You may not actually know. And it may have involved a software vulnerability, it may not have. Attackers like software vulnerabilities and like using exploits for them because there are very clear ways through the security perimeter. But almost always, there are other mechanisms through it. And so malicious software will take advantage of whatever's, you know, the easy path. So what is malicious? I mean, in some sense, malware is just code. And when we say it's malicious, we're talking about purpose. It's a value judgment about code. It's not a technical term. And this matters. Anyone know why?
That would be easy to find it if it were a technical thing. You could.
If it was specific functionality, you probably would have a better chance of finding it. But it's even worse than that. Because, you know, you have malware, you have anti-malware. So anti-malware is software that detects and removes malware. Since I have said that malware is ultimately a value judgment about the software rather than a functional description, so let's say whether it's wanted or not, is it good for you or not? What problem does that put here? It's that it's a question of judgment. I mean, some things are very clear. Okay, the software's trying to format your disk and you didn't ask it to. Okay, that's malicious. But other things aren't so clear. Can you give me an example of something that kind of...
Like some information taken from your computer to give to an advertiser. The person who wrote the program might think that that's a legit business model, but someone at the anti-malware company might think that you're giving up too much and that's not okay.
Spyware. Right? And the related term?
Adware.
Now, there is spyware that you could definitely say was malicious, for example, something installed by a nation state actor or something to spy on dissidents or something to try and, well, maybe I take that back. You consider it malicious, software that's meant to spy on dissidents in order to detect, you know, basically conspiracies against the government. Of course, another time it could be considered legal law enforcement activity in order to detect criminals. What's the difference? Values. That's the only difference. It's a political decision. It's not a technical one. Similarly, when we talk about adware and spyware, we have a word for this. It's called the intranet. You know, what's the modern internet built on? Spyware and adware. You know, it's, you know, what are major things? They're supposed to advertise to you and watch everything you do. You know, Google's, you know, business model, Facebook's business model, some of the biggest companies on the planet, that's their business model. So some other people try to extend that business model to the desktop. Is it so wrong? Maybe?
Now, typically, reason why mainstream adware, you know, things get trying to get rid of adware is because they're stealing someone else's revenue. It's not because they're putting ads, it's because they're replacing ads. There's legitimate ads that are legitimate ads on the website, at least the ones the ad, and then there's the ads that someone with that decided to put on top of it and replace them. So the revenue for clicking on the ads goes somewhere else other than the owner of the website. Okay, you can argue that's theft. But, you know, doesn't seem that different, does it? Really? And then spyware again, you're monitoring everything that happens that you do on the internet. Someone wants to monitor what you do on your desktop? I mean, someone's already watching everything you do anyway. How much of what you do isn't on the internet? Is it much different? I mean, the technical means by which some of these things work against spyware will often try to intercept keystrokes, watch your network activity, watch these. Okay, it's spying on you. What does anti-malware do? Watch your behavior, watch, you know, the things that come in and out of your computer. Watch, I mean, it's all the same mechanism. The only question is an ostensible purpose. So this makes anti-malware a political process. Companies will come, so an anti-malware vendor will come along and say, oh, this is bad, and then that company will sue that you've targeted and say, hey, ours is legitimate business. Why are you removing our software from it? And ultimately, do you know who the arbiter is of what's allowed and what's not at the end of the day?
The user?
No.
Benjamin Franklin.
Lawyers?
No. The platform owner. That's typically the ultimate, you know, one who decides, you know, what's allowed and what isn't, because they control the platform and they can make it so that certain business models will and won't work. The fact that Microsoft Windows allows basically arbitrary software to be installed is a business decision. Is a business decision. We now know other software platforms, other very popular software platforms, have not adopted. iOS does not allow arbitrary code to be installed in their systems. Period. So many embedded devices don't allow anything to be done to this. No outside code at all. It's locked down. I mean, the fact that Windows allows you to install code is because Microsoft says it's okay. And so if they decide certain kinds of programs are or are not allowed, it's their decision. I mean, and you know, maybe that to controlling the granularity of it gets a little bit tricky or something, but they're, at the end of the day, they're the ones who have the most influence on controlling their ecosystem. I mean, think about a Google Chromebook. Google said, you don't install anything on here. Well, now you can install Android apps, okay. But even that, I think, kind of sandboxed off and things that can't really, you know, run on the things. Technically, there's no reason why a Chromebook couldn't install anything just like Windows. It's a full OS. You know, it's a business decision. It's a security decision also. So the whole point of this is anti-malware is an effort to stop malware, but malware is a question of purpose, and that depends on your perspective. And you cannot make the judgment of one or the other based purely on technical means. You have to look at what's the outcome of the computation, and is that desirable for some perspective? And that perspective may or may not involve the user. So, okay, this is all very high-level categories. So that means what, at a technical level, is malware? It's just an application. It's
all it is. It's just program. It's just code.
Yep.
For a long time, it was very easy to create malicious software out of Microsoft Word documents. Right. Macro viruses. What was a macro virus? It's just someone who took a Word document and added some code to it to like send emails or do some other things. I mean, it's just, it's a little VB script. I mean, it's pathetic. I mean, high schoolers were doing this. Just adding code to this and then sending it out. It's like, oh, you made a smart document. Oh, it sends other, it sends emails, copies of itself to other people. Oh, okay. You know, another time that might be called a mailing list. Nothing, the technical mechanisms were put there for a purpose, and this was just a misuse of purpose. But then what about, how do exploits and stuff fit in with that? If I say it's an application, have you ever heard of an application? So let's think of a legitimate application that might want to do things that might be considered to be an exploit.
An updater, scheduled updater.
Scheduled updater, sure.
Password manager.
Password manager, maybe. What about just an application that just wants to run a bit faster? And so it wants to use an undocumented API. Because it turns out the platform has this undocumented API that allows them to do a certain operation 10 times faster than they could otherwise. But the platform vendor doesn't, you know, only keep that particular API for their own use. So they decide to use it. And maybe it turns out that they've added a little bit of obfuscation or something, some little protection so you're not supposed to be able to use that API. So they add in a little bit of code to get around it. To use an API. Nothing malicious, but there's a big use. I mean, that's an application making use of a security vulnerability in an exploit. I know it seems kind of funny, but that's all. A lot of security malware is just doing stuff like that, using undocumented APIs or just even using documented APIs and just using privileges that they were given that the user didn't know they were given.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Concerned that extra privileges becoming...
So the most common use... So what these... In practice, what you're talking about exploits doing in the context of malware is to increase access. So really, this is privilege escalation in some way. Now, often this context of privilege escalation is subdivided. It's thought as only a category, but I actually see it as much broader. So for example, a remote code exploit, where someone just sends your computer packets, and all of a sudden your computer is now taken over by some code. That could be considered to be, oh, that's a remote code exploit. That's not a privilege escalation point. No, it is, because the attacker had a privilege on your system, which was to send packets to it. It just happens to be a privilege that you've given the entire world. But it's still a privilege. They're sending, you know, be able to send you packets, and they're taking that access, and they're getting more access with it. And that's, in general, what these are used to do, is the attacker is given access, some amount of limited access, and they want more access. And so they use some vulnerability in the security mechanism, because the security mechanism was supposed to say, make you say no, and they figure out a way to make it say yes. But the programming involved in here is mostly classic software engineering. I mean, maybe what it is like, oh, there's a library there. Oh, these are the exported functions. No, I'd really like to call this other function. Oh, so you go through it and you find the entry point and you just add a call to that. People used to do this all the time. This is actually the standard way Windows applications were built. And this made backwards compatibility a real pain for Microsoft when they had to change around their code. And that's part of the reason why the intros of Microsoft tradition were really nasty, was because they had to maintain bug compatibility. Because those bugs turned out to be features for certain applications. And if they fix the bug, they would break applications. So that's the problem of anti-malware, and that's the problem of malware, is that it could be almost anything. It's just a question of what the purpose is the attacker wants to do. How does anti-malware actually work in practice then? How do you solve this problem? You have programs that are going to run on your system. Some programs are good, some programs are bad. So there's a couple of basic strategies, right? One is the whitelist. So when we talk about a whitelist is a list of things that are allowed. This is okay. So an invite list for a fancy party is a whitelist. So this is the people who are allowed to come in. Give me an example of a blacklist.
It's a list of anybody but those people.
Right. So, for example, casinos keep lists of people that are not allowed in the casino. Because these people either are known to cheat, or maybe they're just a little too lucky at the games somehow. And so they cause the casinos to lose lots of money, and so they, you know, one casino gets this, and those blacklists get spread. You go to Las Vegas and you are really lucky at one casino and you keep your money and you don't end up losing it again, you're going to go on a list. And that list will be spread to all the other casinos. Then all of a sudden you'll find that, no, they won't necessarily want you there. That's a blacklist. Similarly, you have a list. So either you have a list of what's good, a list of what's bad. What do normal anti-malware soft solutions, typically on Windows, use? They use whitelists or blacklists?
Blacklists.
Mostly, when you're talking about anti-malware systems, you're talking about blacklists. And blacklists suck. Because you have to give a list of all the badness in the world. The whitelist is much simpler because you just have to list them. It doesn't have to be all the goodness, just what you think is good. And you add something new to the whitelist, you go like, okay, yeah, that's something else we should allow. Something new to the blacklist. Oh, there's so many other things to add to the blacklist. So anti-malware is this. What's a security solution that's a whitelist?
Signed code. You can only install signed code.
Yep. So all the modern app stores are fundamentally whitelists. This is code that's allowed on your system, which is presumably gone. Even nowadays with Google Play, you know, even on Android, they are checking their code proactively to say this is okay or not. So functionally, from a device's perspective, the app store provides a whitelist saying this is what's allowed on your system. And if you want to install something else on Android, you can. On iOS, you can't. You by side loading. But that's okay. You're getting around the whitelist. But anti-malware is a completely separate beast. It's saying, okay, I want to make a blacklist of all the things that are not allowed. And as to be clear, it's a hopeless proposition. That's why anti-malware software in general does not work well. Because how could it? You might say, well, why don't we just go with a whitelist? Oh, what? Are they in a position to curate what's allowed? Not really. The only one who really is the platform owners. And they can decide by policy what code is allowed and what's not allowed into their systems. Now, you can get around the whitelist on iOS, actually legitimately, but you have to be a developer. And when you're a developer, then you have to decide which devices could get access to your code. If you want to have wide distribution, you have to go through Apple's vetting process. Let's be a little more technical now. When I say a blacklist, what am I really saying?
Known malware.
So, known malware. Be a little more specific. What do you mean by, how do I identify known malware? Signatures. So, how do we identify the blacklist? One is code signatures. Right, you notice that a certain pattern of code is considered to be bad. Does this potentially lead to problems? Oh, yes. Because what if that particular pattern of code is in a legitimate application? Oops. Every so often, every few years, you typically hear about some high-profile thing where an anti-malware suite all of a sudden got rid of something really important on a bunch of systems, like a key system DLL or something, and how the system will boot.
At work, we had one of the tools we use get flagged by McAfee. It took them like 3 weeks to get back up and running.
Just kidding. Yep. Internal tools are, you know, like that's the word. But it just happened to match because it's a code signature. And you might say, well, wait, why can't I just check the entire application? Typically these code signatures are fragments of an application as opposed to the whole thing. Why don't I just check the whole thing?
Somebody could very easily just change like one little tiny part of the program you've got to use Apple.
Problem with code signatures is polymorphism. The bad guys know they're looking for you, so they keep changing their code.
I was going to ask about that. Would code behavior fall under code signatures per se, or? Because if you could figure out
So when I say code signatures, this is traditionally the actual code. Mm-hmm. And so you have, because of code polymorphism, basically, you know, they just keep randomizing the code in various ways. That makes it very hard to do just simple raw signatures. So what do anti-malware suites do? They run the code. They actually often run the code through emulators, through little environments, where they then look. So the idea is the code on disk has been all obfuscated, but once you unobfuscate it, it has to do certain things, and so they run the emulator and they look for the patterns in the emulator. And so they have signatures of that, as opposed to raw signatures of code. But of course, then the attackers, how the attackers counter that? They make their code more complicated, harder to analyze, or they even make it so they can detect when they're running in an emulator. And then they make their code behave normally, or play benignly while they're in the emulator, and then be badly when they're outside the emulator.
Volkswagen.
Huh? Volkswagen, yes, anti-cheat. Now you might be able, now you could say, well, you know, code that's doing all this really nasty obfuscation stuff and weird stuff, shouldn't we just blacklist it all? Isn't that just all gross code? Shouldn't we just ignore it all? Well, turns out you can't do that. Because legit code uses the same techniques. Any idea why?
Bad developers?
No. This is not bad developers. Because this is way worse than a bad developer. This is like, this is not, oh, my code's kind of disorganized bad. This is actively encrypted, obfuscated code.
Trade secrets,
partially. Although classic encryption kind of mostly does that.
We talked earlier about how video game clients, for example, need obfuscated code.
Exactly. Copy protection. Anti-cheat devices. Because, you know, you don't want someone, you know, a game player to reverse engineer your game so it, you know, they can cheat. Or you don't want them to copy your game. Turns out a lot of stuff people run on commercial systems care about copy protection, so a lot of it's obfuscated. And so here the anti-malware folks are going like, crap. You know, it's like, is this a legit game? Or is this a game infected with malware?
How do you tell the difference? And in fact, some games, their copy protection code should be classified as malware because it does so many nasty things. So now, I mean, the poor anti-malware developers. I mean, it's just like, it's like, okay, you come up with some simple heuristic, like, well, why don't we just look at the behavior? It's like, well, delicious. There's all this mixing of classes. And the anti-malware community has to always side on the side of lower false positives. Because if they start getting rid of too many legit programs, their programs get installed and they lose business.
Can you kind of mix in a whitelist with that blacklist? And so, like, say, yeah, we just flagged the first time that this video game is malware, but then we checked and it's not malware, so now it's on the whitelist. So even though it flags, we just ignore it.
So that's what's happening now. There's companies, there are some next generation companies like Cylance, is one of them, which are doing things where they basically are building giant whitelists, but they're using AI techniques. Basically, they're machine learning techniques. They're classifying a bunch of binaries, getting things into what's good and bad, and saying, these are the characteristics of good applications. And so this is significantly good applications, and they made a whitelist for those, as opposed to, again, a list of all the bad stuff. And so and that's how they can get better performance, is because they basically have a very sophisticated whitelist. Stick that thing on a developer's box, and you're in hell. But on a regular end user system, you're okay. So yes, there's that's where the market, I think, is definitely moving towards away from anti-malware and basically towards sophisticated whitelists, because the blacklist is just hopeless. Because the number of ways, I mean, if you look at the crazy ways in which malware is obfuscated, it's insane. And then you look at the crazy ways in which programs are, you know, done for obfuscation, for copy protection, and for anti-cheating. It's also crazy. I mean, it's just trying to understand trying to look for patterns in the code, and then trying to understand what that code does is almost impossible on purpose. So how can you separate that out? The only way is to like say, okay, well this is legit, and this is, you know, as opposed to going, this is bad, because at least that's relatively easy to fix. Your whitelist misses something, someone puts in a port, you go check it out, you go like, oh, I'll add to my whitelist. Assuming the space of programs is relatively small, relatively speaking. Now, we're seeing the limits of whitelists when you get to app stores. Because in a sense, app stores are built from the ground up to be a whitelist. But now the question is, well, how do you have a whitelist and have the number of applications scale? How do you screen who's allowed to run code on your platform? Because in effect, what has to happen is the app store reviewers have to look at the code and do all the things that the anti-malware folks do. But they have an advantage. What's the advantage that the App Store has?
There's like a screening process they have?
I'm talking about the screening process. I'm saying the App Stores have a fundamental advantage in the screening process.
Don't they control the API for the platform?
Well, it's a platform owners, but what's the advantage in particular they get because of that? Go ahead, please.
The programs who want to run on that software have to maintain to the same standards. So the anti-malware people can actually dictate stuff instead of...
Yeah, exactly. They can basically say no. They can say, your code is obfuscated. We can't figure out what your code does. Reject. It might be legitimate. It might not be. But we don't care. Go away. We have to be able to analyze your code. And they can say, well, what about copy protection? We're providing the copy protection, thank you very much. You don't need to be doing that. That's what our platform provides. Let us see what's going on with your code. So that's a real advantage they have, is they've in effect stepped in and said, we're going to make sure your code is safe on our platform, is not going to be pirated. And they take that's why like Apple takes very aggressive steps to make sure
that iPhones are locked down. It's because they're responsible for providing the guarantee. Developers can't take their own measures, because measures to try to prevent copying of their code will cause their code to be rejected. Unless you do things like you have to have a login or something. I mean, if you want to have to log into a service or something like that, that's kind of a separate thing. But again, that all happens server side. That's not on the device. And you say, oh, you're using the same account too many times. So I could spend a lot of time. We could spend the entire class talking about all the ways anti-malware software works. But honestly, I think it's all out of date. And it's all out of date for the simple reason that, well, it's an unsolvable problem. And this is, if you look at Fred Cohen's work, he talks about all the ways in which it's unsolvable. There's, you know, fundamental theoretical ways, and we're running up against them now. But you just, first of all, you all have learned about undecidability, right? That's in 3804. Where is undecidability covered?
Theory of computation.
Which is?
I think it's 3801 or 3. I can't remember.
Not a requirement.
It's not a required course. Oh, wow. How many of you do not know about decidability?
Well, could
do
you
not
reverse?
Do not know about it. Hmm?
Could you reverse? What is that? Is that like the Spectre problem where they compute both possible user outcomes and then?
No. Decidability is a fundamental result in the theory of computation. So it's better known as the halting problem. So the idea of the halting problem is can you decide if a Turing machine is going to stop running? And you say, well, I would like to have. So one way to decide whether a program stops running is to run the program and see if it stops. But how long do you wait? So if you're going to say, will this ever stop? That requires you potentially to do something faster than running the program. The fundamental result in the theory of computation is that you cannot make a program that is foolproof in deciding whether another program will halt or not. It is undecidable.
Hmm? Isn't that a P versus NP?
No. That's complexity theory. So P versus NP is about speed. It's about how fast it runs. And basically, P is the space of what runs in a reasonable period of time, and NP is the space of results that you can verify in a reasonable time. And so are the results that you can verify in a reasonable time the same as the results that you can obtain in a reasonable time? Undecided. We don't know about. That's undecided in the sense of we haven't proven it in a way. Undecidability is about program behavior in general. Like, does this program halt or not? And what's horrible about this theory, when you really look at it, you realize it's not just whether the program will stop or not. It's any arbitrary property of a program cannot be decided by an algorithm. Any property. Any non-trivial property. I guess like the size of it, but like for example, is a program malware? Is a property? Can that be decided by another program? No, that is undecidable. You cannot make a program that decides that fundamentally. So, what's the solution? Well, you might say, well, that's only theoretical. We can make programs that are good enough. No, actually, modern anti-malware is running up the limits against it because the attackers have gotten their programs to be so complicated, and the good guys make their programs so complicated that distinguishing these classes is not feasible. Precisely. It's always an approximation, and it's always subject to errors. And the error, in order to make it usable in real systems, the errors are moved towards missing malware. And that's why if you're just depending on anti-malware from protecting you, it always misses things. There's really only one thing that anti-malware really helps you with, is it protects you against widespread malware. It prevents an attacker from developing, you know, a piece of malware that can potentially infect a million machines, By having anti-malware out there, once it starts infecting systems, the monitoring systems will detect that, oh wow, bad things are happening. They'll reverse engineer it, some humans will get in the loop, and they'll put in some blocks to stop that malware from infecting a million machines. Or if it does infect a million machines, hopefully they can get most of them back. That's what anti-malware does. It stops the widespread spreading of malware. And this should also make you realize that that only matters on a platform where you can install arbitrary code on it. If you can't run arbitrary code on it, this all goes out the window. So it only really applies to platforms with classic Windows. It does not apply to mobile devices, as long as they're locked down. You might say, well, what if someone breaks past the security of those platforms? Then wouldn't you be in trouble? Yes. And then Apple and Google will deal. It's their problem, because they're the ones providing security guarantees. I'm not saying you can't get past that. I'm saying is, but that's who has to deal with it, as opposed to you just installing a random app that scans for things. So specifically, so just to go into a little more detail, when we say that we have a blacklist, we have code signatures, it's running emulation and stuff, what we're really talking about is an anti-malware suite scans every file, can potentially, won't necessarily do this in order to minimize performance impact, but can scan every file that's on the file system, examine every network connection that's coming in and out of the system, and potentially even inspect the memory of arbitrary processes. Full introspection. That's what an ideal anti-malware suite does, is it watches everything and looks for patterns in anything. And it looks for patterns at the level of specific code signatures and at the level of behaviors. Because really a code signature is just a micro behavior. It's a very specific set of instructions versus a higher level behavior. They're looking for these things. They have heuristics of saying, this kind of looks bad if it's like messing with the registry and we're not installing the program. That's kind of bad, you know. Combine two very detailed things. And they've got databases that are so big, they can't fit on regular computers anymore. That's why all modern anti-malware systems have to be cloud connected in order to work properly. Because they're constantly getting signature updates, and then when they get, and that's actually just part of your signature database. They can't all fit on the system. It's like the hot set, and then they might scan other things in the cloud. But that's all it's doing. So what do I recommend if you're on a Windows box? What should you run? You should run Linux. So question, why is Linux mostly not subject to malware issues?
There's fewer targets.
It's fundamentally about fewer targets. It's not about the platform being fundamentally more secure. In particular, classic Linux allows you to run arbitrary code. Now, it's a bit reduced because in practice, most people who run Linux do not install arbitrary code. They only install code from their distribution. And that distribution has vetted the code in some way and have provided digital signatures for it. So that provides a lot of protection. But if someone uses an exploit or something to get stuff on there, then, you know, that thing is trouble. Mm-hmm.
Isn't, like, most of the world's, like, back end and everything, like, every server is Linux?
Yeah, so pretty much, yeah.
Wouldn't that kind of overwhelm the amount of, like, computers that people have that run Windows still? Like, wouldn't you say that Linux has a higher number of computers than Windows?
Arguably, yes. We're going to talk. So there's another problem, the intrusion detection problem, which we are not talking about today, which we'll talk about, I think, probably after the final, after the midterm.
You can argue that servers are not end users, though.
Yes. So, anti-malware really is a problem for client machines. And it's a problem for client machines because they're the ones where people install random applications. Servers normally have a much smaller footprint of what code they run. They do just a lot of computation, lots of storage activity, but it's a small set of code, and someone has vetted that before and said, okay, now we've got 10,000 machines all running the same code. It's not to say you can't have malware there, but it's just you aren't changing the code that's running on the systems often. So malware is coming. Exploits are still an issue. Attackers are still an issue. But the character of malware changes. And so the anti-malware suites definitely don't make sense in that context. But other things, a blacklist approach is dumb. A whitelist approach is very important. But then it comes, the whitelist may be, how do I make sure the right image is installed on the server? So it changes. But so now if you're running Windows, what should you be running? Should you be running no anti-malware? No.
Isn't Defender regarded as pretty decent?
Yes. I say you run Windows Defender. Basically, the anti-malware software that comes from Microsoft, which runs by default. Because, first of all, you have to trust Microsoft anyway. Because if they mess up, you're already, in big trouble. Microsoft has incentives to make sure their anti-malware solution does not compromise the performance of the platform. And they also have incentives to make sure the big threats are taken care of. Will they necessarily take care of every little thing? No, but no one can take care of every little thing. And they care about making sure their anti-malware suite will not be compromised. And that really matters, because a lot of these anti-malware suites are very badly coded. Which is kind of funny when you think about how much access does the anti-malware suite require? Everything. It has maximal access. It can do anything because it has to. So you're installing this code that can do anything to your system, and what happens if it gets compromised? Is it particularly better engineered? No, it's actually worse engineered typically, because they're trying to sell this product. So before Microsoft had a solution for this, it was probably important for to run third-party things. Nowadays, I've not seen one that isn't crap. I just thought, wow, I just last week, I was helping someone out with, they had their computer. And it was like, wow, our computer seems all messed up and everything. And it's like, and I look at it, oh God, you got McAfee on there or something. It's like, maybe it was more, one of the big ones. And it was just like, and I looked at the process list, and I'm going like, there's like 10 processes running for this thing. And they seem to be running all the time. And it's like, no wonder this thing's running at a snail's pace. It's like, I'm doing nothing, and there's all this stuff going on. It's like, no. It had other issues, but.
I used to have Kaspersky on my laptop, and once I installed it, it literally took about 10 minutes just to turn on, and then I got rid of it, and it was just as fast as when I first bought it.
I'm not saying that these anti-malware suites will not stop some malware that Microsoft might miss. Because Microsoft is the default one, all the attackers are going to make sure they get it. And other ones, get some protection back. But the problem is will it really protect you when you need it? And would other techniques help you better? I mean, frankly, you have to be careful in what you download. I mean, if you install bad software on your system, you're just dead. It's going to get past everything. And maybe surfing the web, your best protection against that is running up-to-date software. If you're running up-to-date, latest patched, patching your security updates and particularly making your browsers up-to-date, and making sure your extensions aren't malicious. Because that's a lot of malware now is malicious web browser extensions. So if you make sure that isn't it, I'm not saying you're perfectly protected. But if you want to get more protection, you really start having to play with things like virtual machines or reduced functional environments or alternate operating systems and stuff. That's where you get more things rather than running an anti-malware suite. Choosing a better password. Password managers, they're definitely better than having the same password everywhere, but they are a source of vulnerability. So, but let's talk about those iPhones. We're talking about malware. How do you get... Does anyone know the classic term for compromising the security of an iPhone device?
Jailbreak.
Jailbreak. So you've heard the term jailbreak? Seems like a very... So this is actually a technical term. What is that technical term referring to?
BSD jails.
BSD jails. So let's look. So let's do my classic. So we have hardware. We have an OS. And these are processes, so like Firefox or something. You have hardware, you have the OS, you have the OS kernel, or something, and then you have applications running on it and some number of processes. Malicious software, if you're going to run it, can come in two forms. One is, if it's taking advantage of an exploit, it can go into one of these processes here, compromise that process, use its privileges that this process has in order to do whatever it wants, maybe start other processes, maybe modify the file system, whatever. The other way is the attacker manages to get someone to install the application, and the attacker has their own. You have a bad process running on there. You have a malicious process running right here. And it now is trying to mess with the other applications or mess with the OS or mess with the files or whatever and send stuff on the network. This, well, I should really... So there's a file system here. And then there's... So the OS is talking to the network, talking to the file system. These, of course, are. This is actually an Ethernet card or something, but really it's more software abstraction. We talk about IP addresses, or we talk about files on disk. There's communication there. So on a classic operating system, once you have a process on the system, I mean, either you controlled a process here, or you have your own process. What can you do then? I mean, a process by itself isn't actually dangerous that much. I mean, maybe consume a lot of RAM, but it's not really, that's not so bad. Where's the badness come in? It's in messing with this, messing with this. It's in changing files on disk, maybe installing itself disk so it can run later. Maybe deleting files, maybe monitoring files, or like sending arbitrary network packets, maybe conducting denial of service attacks, but it's changing the state of the system rather than just, you know, doing a few computations. This is actually still largely the architecture of Android. With Android, all you get is a lot more fine-grained permissions compared to a typical desktop operating system. A lot of things for whether you can access the internet, whether you can access the file system. There's lots of little bits. But it's just a very elaborate permission model. It's a capabilities-based model for the application. This is not what iOS looks like. How does iOS differ?
They use a lot more of the sandboxing techniques.
Sandboxing techniques. Yes, but to what end? I mean, you'd say browsers do sandboxing, which basically human pages
within each application.
Kind of.
Gross.
So on iOS, there's still, let's say, this hardware. But above it, logically, it's not running processes so much. Instead, it's running kind of containers. And the inside the containers are processes. And these containers each have access to their own FS. So really, each application installed on an iOS device kind of thinks it has the entire phone. It's very much like if you have web hosting. If you get access to a web host, and you have SSH access and SMTP access, it looks like you have an entire little Linux box. Because you have all your files, you have your applications and everything. There may be like another 1,000 other websites running on the same host. You don't see their files. You don't see their processes. You don't even see their user IDs. You see no evidence of them being on the box. You're all still sharing the same kernel, same hardware, but you've been separated off, so you can't see anyone else. So this is the notion of a jail. It's that you are jailed off, but really it's OS virtualization. The OS is instead of providing a process-level virtualization, it's almost an entire system kind of virtualization. You have your own copy of the file system, you have your own set of processes, user IDs, and everything. You're boxed off. You don't see anyone else. So a jailbreak on an iOS application is specifically to eliminate this isolation so that all applications can see each other. And once they can see each other, you basically are running the equivalent of a regular desktop OS. Everyone can see everyone else, and so now you can do all the fun things you can do on a standard desktop OS, such as mess with processes and mess with the files and provide introspection and everything. So it provides desktop OS-like functionality by destroying the security mechanism that kept you safe. Because what kept you safe here was that these applications, since they can't see each other, they can't mess with each other. This is why on iOS, you don't have a shared file system. When you want to open a file in another app, it copies it from one to the other because they don't share a common file space. On a normal desktop OS, you'd be like, this is stupid. But now they provide ways of mirroring it. iOS has it's partial decryption, it's not decryptable. I mean, it's iOS, their security model is pretty hardcore. They've gone through, it's the most locked down platform I've seen. I mean, in some ways it's offensive to me because it means that you really can't control it, but given the alternative from a security perspective, I just can't say it's worse because it certainly protects people better. And also it means that this application can't monitor that application. It can't spy on it, because it can't see it. And anytime, I'm not saying this is a perfect isolation. There have been found vulnerabilities. And in fact, that's what the jailbreak community has been doing, has been finding ways to bust out of this thing. And every time they find ways to bust out, Apple comes along and patches it. It's not because they hate them. It's because they have, as the platform owner, they have the responsibility for maintaining the security model. If they don't, no app can protect themselves. Microsoft, in some sense, before didn't actually promise that. The whole notion of the platform owner having a security requirement is a very modern idea. I mean, older personal computers, the idea is you just run whatever you want. What's the big deal? And the notion that the person who gave you that software had any way of protecting you? What's security? I mean, it's like, don't share floppies of pirated software. that was kind of the thing they'd say. Why'd you do that? Of course you got some virus that deleted all your files. Stop doing that. But they can't make that argument anymore.
I remember the notion of security was fairly new back in like the 80s and 90s. Because when my dad was at an IT company, he told me once that when he went to start doing support on site, they had the computer in a clean room and they had to take their shoes off and everything just to make sure that the computer didn't get a virus. The one they didn't know anything about, and that's what security was to them. That's what a virus.
They had to wear booties so it didn't get a virus.
Dust is dangerous though, so that ended up being helpful, right?
Huh?
It ended up being helpful because dust clogs stuff up.
Well yes,
you know,
but
unintentionally.
Not,
yeah. Yes, it's helpful, but no. Computers can get a cough.
Modern security is just educating those kind of people who are still in the industry.
But the thing is, even... So, how do you know, if you are on a platform that allows you to install arbitrary code, how do you make sure you don't install bad code? I mean, think of it. You're using GitHub. You download code from GitHub all the time onto your system. How do you know that isn't have all kinds of crap in it? Do you make sure you run that in a jail in a little isolated environment so it can't affect anything else? Probably not, because it's really inconvenient. You know, in some ways, developers are the worst, because we run all kinds of code and just doing things, and basically it's okay, but there's bad stuff out there, and how do you tell the difference? I mean, the real way we tell is, like, whoa, I didn't expect my computer to do that. But what if the attack was sophisticated? There's all kinds of things of like state-level actors infecting the developers of open-source software with targeted attacks, so they can insert malicious code into that, you know, into the developer code. And then it's like, how do you protect against that? I mean, I will talk about what it is, but it's not a simple problem. But it's a very different problem from just talking about having vulnerability and exploits and running malicious software. That's not the game you want to be playing. If you're playing this game where you're trying to detect the malicious software, you are going to lose. All you can control is how bad the score is. But in some sense, if you've lost, you've already lost. So it's like, try to avoid playing that game. Last questions?
So it seems like BSD and iOS, to some extent macOS, they had jails like as a security mindset for such a long time before Linux got into like, containerization and all that. Why has it taken Linux so long to sort of catch up, and have they really?
Well, BSDs have had jails for a long time. And Linux actually has had equivalent functionality for a very long time. It's just gone on the level of OS virtualization and has been mainly used in the web hosting domains, which frankly is where BSD was used as well. That's where those jails came in. So the difference is whether it's been mainstream. Jails in the BSD context were part of the core. A lot of the OS virtualization on the Linux side was not part of core Linux. It was kind of separate things that people had to patch on. Why it became part of the core Linux kernel, why didn't it become, is because the Linux kernel folk kind of thought, this code messes everything up. It makes our code ugly, and we don't like that, we can't maintain it. And with containerization, they basically have bitten the bullet and have now cleaned up the code so that basically they're abstracting everything. Like now in the Linux kernel, when you have a process ID, it's abstracted away in namespaces. So you can have multiple namespaces of process IDs, because the notion of process ID 2401 could mean different things depending upon what context you're in. And that's the infrastructure they're now using for doing containers. But again, even containers still locking them down. I mean, if you look at really the jails, they aren't airtight. The ones who have gotten things most airtight is honestly iOS.
And that's because they've been in a highly adversarial environment and they've been locking it down over time. We haven't done that on any of the platform. So everything's still Swiss cheese, whether you want to admit it or not, which is worrisome. I think as desktop environments are starting, we have to figure out how to do this. The things that are bulletproof now, that are as bulletproof as you can get now, in terms of providing isolation, it's web browsers and iOS jails. iOS, isolation. That's about it. Because those are the only things that have been battle tested. So, next, on Wednesday, we'll be reviewing for the midterm and talking about the assignment. Monday will be the midterm. And then after that, we'll start talking about intrusion detection.